me. Marco smiled, noticing that she had lovely green eyes, dark red hair waving to her shoulders, and a body that filled every curve of her uniform.
Please don't tell my boss. We set up the food for the reception, but it's supposed to be for the brass.
Who can resist panna cotta? Marco found himself flirting, for the first time in a long time. It felt strange, especially with Elisabetta's engagement ring in his pocket.
Not me, it's my favorite.
Mine too. What's your name?
Fiorella, and I already know who you are, Marco.
Fiorella smiled.
I saw you climb the pillar at Commendatore Bonacorso's party. You were amazing.
Really? Marco asked, perking up.
He began to feel good,
like in the old days. Fiorella was a beautiful girl, and there were so many desserts he had been passing up to no end. From now on, he was going to eat everything.
I know Tino at Palazzo Braschi, and he said you have a girlfriend.
Not anymore. Marco pushed Elisabetta from his mind by sheer act of will. Do you have a boyfriend?
No, I don't.
Then this is my lucky day.
Marco brushed a strand of hair from her lovely eyes.
May I taste your panna cotta?
Yes, of course.
Fiorella reached for her plate, but Marco stopped her with a gentle touch, then leaned in for a kiss.
Evening fell, and Marco walked home through a city throbbing with excitement. People filled the streets, restaurants, and bars, celebrating, arguing, and discussing the amazing news of the day. He had never felt better in his uniform, and though he wished he was old enough to enlist and fight, he would settle for working at Palazzo Venezia. He was riding high on adrenaline and pride in himself and his country. Italy was going to war, and she was going to win. Marco reached Ponte Fabricio and climbed the bridge, breathing in the familiar dampness of the Tiber. His thoughts turned to Elisabetta, because he was heading toward Trastevere, and he slipped a hand into his pocket, feeling for the diamond ring. It was still there, but she belonged in his past. Plenty of other girls were in his future. He was off to a fast start with Fiorella. Marco descended the other side and saw his father, hustling from one customer to the next, in a packed outside seating area. If they had been on better terms, Marco would have been excited to tell him about being hired at Palazzo Venezia. Marco wondered if those days were truly over. He reached the bar and crossed to his father.
Papa, were you at Piazza Venezia for the speech?
No, I was busy here.
His father frowned.
Where have you been?
Bonacorso brought me over. I work at Palazzo Venezia now. I was in the same room as Il Duce. It was a wonderful day for Italy.
War may be necessary, but never wonderful.
His father pursed his lips.
And I heard you were in front of Massimo's house last night, saying the most hateful things. Shame on you.
Marco's mouth went dry.
I didn't mean it. I was angry. Go put on an apron. Big shot.
Chapter 61 Elisabetta, September 1940. Elisabetta served coffee while the women took their seats around a long table at Casa Servano, ready for the meeting. The war had gone on over the summer, with awful bombing in London and other cities. Rome had been spared so far, and day-to-day life in the capital city continued mostly unchanged. Local businesses thrived due to the influx of dignitaries and military. There were shortages of men and food, but one bothered Elisabetta more than the other. She was through with love. Nonna sat at the head of the table, having recovered from her pneumonia.
Ladies, settle down. We have to get started.
Elisabetta sat down behind her gleaming black Olivetti typewriter with its black letters on lovely white keys. Women quieted their children and took babies onto their laps. There were seven of them, all mothers who ran restaurants in Trastevere since their husbands had gone to war. Nonna had formed an informal restaurant association to help guide them, for they had besieged her with questions. She was solely in charge of Casa Servano now, because her son Paolo had enlisted.
We'll begin where we left off. Elisabetta, please read the minutes from the last meeting.
Elisabetta began. We in the restaurant business are experiencing difficulties getting flour, olive oil, and butter from our regular suppliers. Rationing has been affecting flour, butter, olive oil, rice, and pasta. Our main problem is getting flour from our regular vendors at reasonable prices. Italy has always produced abundant supplies of wheat for flour. As you may know, the government devised the Amassi plan, whereby farmers who produced wheat would give it to a central collective, which would ensure the food was evenly distributed.
You mean, in short, the graft was evenly distributed?
Nonna interjected, and everybody laughed. Then Elisabetta continued. Farmers are being sent to war, and farms are being shut down, so food production is suffering. In the provinces, families are becoming malnourished. Elisabetta felt a pang that this would happen in her country, which loved its food so well.
Wheat and flour supplies are diminishing, and the decrease is hurting us. A black market has sprung up, but it is not an alternative for us, as we require large quantities. Some of us reported ridiculous prices, like these: flour, 260 lire per kilo, sugar, 450 lire per kilo, butter, 700 lire per kilo, oil, 800 lire per kilo, Parmesan cheese, 600 lire per kilo, salt, 350 lire per kilo, rice, 250 lire per kilo, eggs, 15 lire each.
Nonna clucked, and the women around the table shook their heads. The babies in their laps patted the tablecloth or played with napkins.
At our last meeting, we distributed a list of suppliers that Casa Servano has found the most reliable and low-priced. Feel free to use them. That is the end of old business. We can proceed to new.
Elisabetta stopped talking when she heard the door opening and looked up, shocked to see that it was Beppe Terizzi. His large, muscular frame filled the doorway, backlit by the sunlight, and his build was an older version of Marco's. All of the women gawked at him, reacting to his dark good looks and powerfully masculine presence. Elisabetta understood instantly what her mother had seen in him, for she herself had seen the same things in Marco. The thought disturbed her, and she lowered her gaze to her typewriter. Nonna acknowledged him with a nod.
Ciao, Beppe. It's been a long time.
Yes, it has, Giuseppina. I heard about the meeting and thought I might attend to help.
Good. Feel free to take a seat.
Thank you.
Beppe brought over a chair and sat down at the other head of the table, opposite Nonna.
Nonna gestured.
Ladies, this is Beppe Terizzi, the owner of the very successful Bar Giro Sport on Tiber Island. Quickly introduce yourself and say the name of your restaurant.
I'm Isabella from Franco's Ristorante, began the first woman,
and Elisabetta tuned out, composing herself. She hadn't seen Marco or Sandro since her birthday, and she had exiled them both to the back of her mind. She had asked around to see if anyone knew whether fascists had broken her father's hands. No one had any answers, not even Nonna. After the introductions were finished, Nonna glanced at Beppe.
Last week I distributed a list of vendors that I have had good experiences with. I will make sure you get one.
Beppe lifted an eyebrow. You share your vendors with the competition.
Nonna blinked behind her glasses.
We don't regard each other as competition. We rise or fall together. I expect you to bring a list of your vendors to the next meeting.
Beppe nodded, his expression impassive.
Now, is there any new business?
Nonna looked around the table.
I have something,
said Gaia, a young, dark-haired mother with a toddler on her lap.
I have some signs. I think they could increase business to our restaurants.
Excellent,
Nonna smiled and heads nodded.
I had them printed for everyone. My uncle is a printer and did it for free. I'll show you.
Gaia dug into her tote bag, produced a stack of printed signs, and held one up. Negozio Ariano, or Aryan Business, it read, meaning that the store was owned by Gentiles, not Jews. Elisabetta stopped typing. Nonna cleared her throat.
I would never put that sign in my window. It's offensive. Many of our neighbors in Trastevere are Jewish.
Gaia frowned.
With respect, I'm putting one up. Anybody else want a sign for free?
Leandra raised her hand.
I do, please. I put my family before anybody else's.
Isabella raised her hand, too.
I have three children to feed. I can't afford the niceties.
Gianna nodded.
I'll take two signs, one for me and one for my neighbor. She runs a dress shop.
Nonna leaned forward, placing her arthritic hands on the table.
Ladies, please reconsider. Trastevere is home to painters, musicians, and writers, a veritable artists' colony. The effect of the race laws on Jewish artists has been devastating. They aren't permitted to work in public radio, theater, or music, or private entertainment. Textbooks by Jewish authors are no longer in use, nor are maps signed by Jews. They are our neighbors, our friends.
I agree, Elisabetta nodded. Of course you do. You work for her.
Gaia smirked, cuddling her baby. Leandra frowned.
We didn't write the race laws. We're in business.
Nonna pursed her lips, her vexation plain.
When I formed this organization, it was to save Trastevere, not merely our businesses.
Trastevere will survive if we do,
Gaia shot back. Nonna frowned.
No. We must lift our gaze from our own plates. A community is comprised of people, all of its people.
Gaia smoothed her baby's hair.
Giuseppina, we know you own many houses in the neighborhood. There will always be a roof over your head. I can't say the same thing.
The women nodded around the table, siding with Gaia.
Suppose so.
Beppe began to say, then all of the women looked to him, since he was known as a prominent fascist.
No sign for me.
In the end, one restaurant owner after another took a sign. The only two who didn't were Nonna and Beppe, who agreed about nothing else. It wasn't until the end of the day that Elisabetta had the chance to finalize her notes from the meeting. She sat behind the Olivetti, but she couldn't stop thinking about Beppe Terizzi. His presence lingered, a ghost at the head of the table, and he loomed larger than life to her, since his past intertwined with her own. She wondered how long his affair with her mother had lasted, and how much of her childhood it had spanned, why it had started or how it had ended. She doubted she would ever know. Nonna entered the dining room, holding her purse and a paper bag reeking of leftover fish.
Aren't you finished? It's time to go home.
Not yet.
How long can it take?
Nonna peered at the typed page.
You haven't started. What have you been doing?
I've been distracted. I was thinking about the meeting.
That disgusting sign.
Nonna eased into her chair, setting down her things.
Weak people abound, strong people abide.
Elisabetta had heard her say that before, many times.
There have always been anti-Semites, as there have always been fleas. Both are insignificant and brainless, having no purpose other than to torment their betters. I pray that someday we will be rid of them. But until then, we can only bathe to keep them at bay.
It was strange at the meeting, with Beppe there.
Nonna smiled slyly.
Oh, yes. It killed him to agree with me.
He agreed because of his friendship with Massimo Simone, Sandro's father.
No, he agreed because I'm right.
Nonna snorted.
Handsome Beppe Terizzi. Did you see those women? The ones who weren't salivating were lactating.
Elisabetta chuckled.
So is that what's been distracting you? Marco again, or Sandro? When are you going to put them behind you? You don't think I hear you at night, crying like a little baby. Boo-hoo.
Nonna imitated her. Elisabetta felt taken aback.
That's not nice.
Have we met?
Nonna arched a gray eyebrow.
Don't you think it's time to move on?
I'm not ready to start dating again.
Was I talking about men? Why must it always be about men? Don't you remember when I told you, preserve your independence?
Nonna, I can't be more independent than I am. I live like a nun.
Virginity and independence are not the same thing. Sex, love, romance, men, that's all that fills your head. What about this, under your nose?
Nonna gestured at the Olivetti.
Remember when you wanted to become a writer? When I introduced you to Gualeschi? When Marco, Sandro, or whoever bought you a notebook? How much encouragement do you need, Elisabetta? How many others will dream your dreams for you? What will it take for you to become the woman whom God intended you to be?
Elisabetta felt hurt. For Nonna sounded right.
What are you waiting for? When do you want to begin your future? What time is better than now?
Nonna tapped the typewriter with her curved fingernail.
If you were Jewish, you wouldn't be permitted to write. You're throwing away a right denied to others for no reason, by fleas.
Elisabetta felt ashamed. It was true. But I don't know if I can write or what to write about.
You live in fascinating times. Write about them on a typewriter made by the Olivetti family, which hates fascism. If you can't write now, you're no daughter of mine.
Daughter? Nonna must have misspoken, but Elisabetta wasn't going to correct her. Nonna eased from her chair.
Let's go home. The cats await, and that typewriter is portable for a reason.
Chapter 62. Sandro. October 1940. Sandro and Rosa walked down Via del Portico d'Ottavia, under gray skies. They were on their way to buy bread from their black market connection, a transaction that required the two of them. Sandra would make the purchase, while Rosa served as lookout, a method a necessity because Jews caught buying on the black market would be fined, and if they couldn't pay, arrested. They had no choice but to buy in the black market because food and other essentials were scarce, especially in the ghetto, where so many shops had closed. They greeted neighbors as they passed, but the main thoroughfare was emptier than ever.
Nobody was selling anything on the street anymore, after another set of race laws had revoked the licenses for peddling of any kind, which had the effect of denying income even to rag traders. Worst of all, last week, Mussolini had ordered all Jews to leave the country. Most Jews ignored the law, as they were too poor to travel to any country that would accept them. "What do you think we should do about the new law?" Sandro asked, looking over at his sister. They often discussed important matters outside the house, so as not to upset their parents, especially their father.
"I think fascists want us out. They made it official."
Rosa shook her head, walking along. Her hair was up in a twist, and her face was lovely, if leaner. Like all of them, she had lost weight, so that a red coat fit loosely. Its bright color had dulled, and the lapel stitching had come free.
"We don't have the money to emigrate now, even if we wanted to."
"Correct." Sandro knew the numbers, and they kept him up at night. He stretched every lira they had left.
"And we have nowhere to emigrate to, now that the war is on. We can't go to Britain or France anymore, and Poland and the Netherlands are already under Nazi rule."
Rosa looked over. "The only option left is Palestine, but I hear the waiting list is too long."
"I can't believe it's come to this. Still, I can't believe it."
"I can. I was wrong, and you were right all along."
"Don't feel bad. You didn't want to believe it. You love your country. You couldn't imagine she would turn on you."
Rosa shrugged.
"What is a country if not her people?"
"Right." Sandro felt a rush of regard for her. "You know, you didn't have to come back. You put yourself in this all over again."
"I'm with my family."
Rosa smiled, but Sandro knew she was putting on a brave face. "Papa's worse, don't you think?"
"Yes. He's anxious and preoccupied all the time.
I don't know how to help him, other than what I'm already doing."
"There's nothing, Sandro. You're doing enough."
They turned right, then left, heading out of the ghetto. And it felt to Sandro that they were entering a different world. Outside, stores and businesses were thriving, and well-dressed Romans went about their quotidian business, living the life that the Simones used to live. Rosa walked with her head down, a frown marking her pretty features.
"I got a letter from one of my British friends saying it's terrible in London right now. The city is being bombed, and everyone's hiding in the tube at night. Now that Hitler's taken France, Britain stands alone. Churchill will never surrender, but I don't know if the Brits can stop the Nazis."
"How frightening," Sandro shuddered.
"It horrifies me that Italy is on Hitler's side, and I'm married to a Brit. My own country is trying to kill my husband. How can that be?"
"Everything is topsy-turvy. The Allies are on the right side, and we're on the wrong one.
I had news of David. He got reassigned to a group called the SOE, a Special Operations Division. They go behind the lines to disrupt the enemy in any way they can, blowing up rail lines and the like."
Sandro hid his dismay.
"But he's a diplomat." "I know. They picked him for his diplomatic knowledge and language skills. I heard that from our old embassy friends. The rest is top secret. I don't even know where he is."
Rosa bit her lip, and seeing her anxiety, Sandro stopped her and gave her a warm hug. "It's going to be okay."
"Is it?"
Rosa released him, her eyes filming. They resumed walking, and she sighed.
"Sandro, we talk about David and me all the time, but we never talk about you and Elisabetta. Every time I bring her up, you change the subject. What happened that night, on her birthday?"
"Nothing."
Sandro's chest ached. "Come on, you lied to me."
Rosa lifted an eyebrow.
"You told me that she chose Marco, but I heard what she said to you that night. She chose you, and you sent her away."
"It was for her own good."
"She didn't think so. She wants you. She told you so."
"Marco is better for her," That's her decision to make, not yours. You love her. You should have told her that.
Why?
It's the truth. You don't need a reason for the truth.
Sandra wished it were that simple. I couldn't see her now, even if I wanted to. Mixed couples are under surveillance these days. We can't have Ovra watching us. If they did, we couldn't meet our connection. How would we get food, or anything else we need?
Maraza was silent a moment, walking along.
We would figure it out.
Elisabetta never gave up on you. She probably still hasn't.
Sandro didn't want to believe that was true. He didn't want to think he could have Elisabetta back, for it only kept his heart broken. All of the reasons he had let her go still existed, whether she saw Marco or not.
Sandro, you should go to her. Just tell her you love her, and let the rest fall as it may.
Oh, is that your romantic advice?
Sandro smiled, remembering a happier time when she had advised him about Elisabetta. Yes, and bring her flowers.
Rosa smiled back. I brought her a book, and it worked.
Ha! Sandro spotted their connection. A dirty little man with a cap pulled down, standing on the street corner. There he is. He's waiting for us.
Sandro, you really should tell Elisabetta.
Enough! Keep an eye out for the police.
Chapter 63. Beppe. December 1940. Beppe carried two wine glasses to Massimo's table in the back of the empty bar. The two men had fallen into a routine, and Massimo would slip through the side entrance after closing time, have something to eat, and take home a bag of groceries.
How was the panino?
Beppe sat down, noticing that every crumb of the sandwich was gone. His old friend had lost weight, and his worn brown suit hung on him. His omnipresent folder of papers lay open next to him, having grown even thicker.
It was delicious. Did Maria make it?
Massimo pushed his plate away.
No, Letizia.
How is Maria doing? Still upstairs?
Yes, but she's getting out more. She goes to mass. Emilio takes her.
It must be hard. I'm sorry.
The war makes it worse. She reads the newspaper, the reports of the dead. She sees which ones are Aldo's age, or whether they're younger or older. She mourns them like her own.
How sad.
It's odd to be home in wartime, isn't it?
Yes. Beppe and Massimo locked eyes, soldier to soldier. Beppe's old knee injury had prevented him from serving this time, and Jews were not permitted to serve. Massimo sighed heavily.
Though I have to say, when I hear that the war is going badly for us, I don't know whether to rejoice or weep.
I understand. Beppe sipped his wine. We're off to a rocky start in the Mediterranean. The naval defeat at Taranto was an embarrassment. I'm hoping the Egyptian front goes better. But I feel ambivalent too.
Understood.
Massimo opened his folder, slid a pen from his pocket, and made a note.
On the other hand, it pains me to admit that the Germans have had success. Their blitzkrieg is something new altogether. Hitler occupies much of Western Europe.
Yes. Massimo made another note.
I rue the day we joined forces with the Nazis. We're Hitler's vassals, that's all.
Beppe watched Massimo take notes, which was becoming more frequent.
What are you writing, Massimo?
Important things I have to remember. They need to be written down.
Massimo turned the folder around and showed Beppe a line of figures.
See, this is the census in August 1938. There were 15,000 applications for exemptions to the race laws, Massimo.
Beppe interrupted him.
You told me this already.
Many times.
Oh, I did?
Massimo blinked.
Did I show you the families who got exemptions based on exceptional merits?
Yes.
Massimo, how are you feeling, brother?
As well as can be expected.
Massimo turned the folder right side up.
I'm proud of my work. I'm able to serve the community.
You know, I got the exemptions for many of those families. They were granted on applications I prepared or supervised. I wish I could have done it for my own family. I deserved it on the merits. I just missed that 1 year. I wish I'd joined the party earlier, like you. We've discussed this many times. It's not your fault. Beppe paused. I'm worried about you. You don't seem like yourself. You need a break. A break?
Massimo's eyes flared behind his glasses.
It's not like the old days at the office. The community needs me. It's suffering. Nobody has work, there's no money, and we struggle daily to eat.
His words sped up, running over one another.
I've trained people to file the applications. 16 people work for me at the synagogue, but every time we file one application, we find another family who needs one. It never ends.
I understand that. But you can't solve everything yourself.
I feel as if you're trying to redeem yourself for not getting the exemption.
Perhaps I am.
But what's the harm in that? I don't want another family to be in our position.
I'll tell you the harm. Beppe kept his tone without judgment. You're trying to redeem yourself for something that wasn't your fault. You're neglecting your family in the process. Be home more. That's your place.
But I can't simply stop.
I'm not saying stop. I'm saying cut down. Beppe closed Massimo's folder.
Your mind is on your work all the time.
That's what Sandro says. Massimo frowned.
He's right, your son. Talk to me about him, not this folder.
How is Sandro these days?
I don't see much of him. I'm at the synagogue. He's off with Rosa or at school. He runs the house.
What do you mean?
He's taken over the household finances, such as they are, so I can work.
But it's not his place.
Beppe frowned. You're the head of the Simone family. Remember who you are. Resume your proper role. Everything else will fall into place. It will do you good.
Maybe I will.
Massimo straightened, blinking. How's Marco?
He likes working at Palazzo Venezia, and at night he sees girls.
Beppe paused.
Again, I'm sorry for those things he said at your house. I'm ashamed.
Of course he didn't mean it. You apologized already.
These are dark and hard times. There's suffering and war. But wars end. That we know. That we have lived.
Yes, they end.
Massimo pursed his lips.
And then they begin again.
In time, Beppe slipped Massimo out the side entrance, then locked up. He left to go upstairs when he heard banging on the front door. He turned around to see Carmine Vecchio through the glass, a runty figure in his dark Ovra uniform.
Beppe went to the door and unlocked it, blocking the threshold.
We're closed, he said, matter-of-factly.
You're feeding that little Jew. I saw you. I know you.
Carmine's eyes glittered with malice.
I feed every customer. The day that becomes illegal, throw me in jail.
Simone is not a customer. He's a friend. You think you can get away with it because Marco works at Palazzo Venezia?
My son has nothing to do with it. Your grudge with me goes back. You were a punk then, and you're a punk now.
Carmine wagged a finger.
Don't think I can't get to you.
Go ahead. Try.
Oh, your little Jew friend.
Don't dare touch him.
Carmine snickered.
The Simones are your Achilles heel. It's written all over your face.
I warn you, don't touch him.
I have Ovra behind me. What will you do to me?
Don't find out,
Beppe answered, through clenched teeth. Out of nowhere, the thought occurred to him to kill Carmine with his bare hands, right then and there. It was an instinct forged in combat, the reflex of a soldier to protect a brother of his company. He had done it in war, many times.
You don't scare me, Beppe.
Because you're stupid.
Beppe stepped back and closed the door, eyeing Carmine through the glass. Beppe had always believed there were battles that a man needed to walk away from, and battles than a man needed to fight. Carmine had just become the latter.
Chapter 64. Elisabetta, March 1941. Elisabetta and Nonna sat at the dining room table, nursing their nightcaps of anisette. The house was quiet and tranquil, and the breeze through the open window billowed the lace curtains. Rico slept on his chair, with Gnocchi on hers, their seat cushions covered with white doilies to collect cat hair, which was a lost cause. Nonna nodded.
"We did well this week. We were even with last, so we're holding our own."
"You deserve the credit." Elisabetta smiled, pleased.
"Do I disagree?"
"No." Nonna laughed, and Elisabetta joined her.
Casa Servano was still in business thanks to Nonna's strategy, which was serving only their house specialty, pasta. All other entrees had been eliminated. And Elisabetta bartered everything they had for flour and eggs. Others in the trade association had followed suit, focusing on their own various specialties. Beppe had never come to another meeting, though he had left them his list of vendors.
"Elisabetta, how are you doing with your book?"
"Fine, thanks."
Elisabetta finished the last of her anisette, which tasted licorice sweet. She had begun to write the night she first brought home the Olivetti, and what had started as a lark had turned into a discipline. She would start writing after their nightcap and not stop until she had finished 500 words. Some nights it would take her until 1 o'clock in the morning, and other nights until almost dawn.
"When are you going to let me read it?"
"When I'm finished,"
Elisabetta answered firmly, since they had had the conversation many times.
"Why are you taking so long?"
"It takes time."
"You're not going on and on, are you?"
"No, I hope not."
Elisabetta rose, smiling.
"Now I have to get to work."
"Why can't I read it now? Don't you realize I'll have valuable suggestions?"
"I'm sure, and you can make them when I'm finished."
Elisabetta picked up her glass, but Nonna stopped her.
"You think I don't know how to wash a glass. Now tell me, what's your book about?"
"You'll see soon. Good night."
Elisabetta kissed Nonna on the cheek, picked up the Olivetti, and went upstairs, her thoughts already turning to her book. The story had completely captured her imagination, and she realized that Nonna had been right. Writing had given her something to think about other than Sandro or Marco. She entered her bedroom, switched on the light, and set the Olivetti on her desk. She changed into her nightgown, so she wouldn't wrinkle her dress, then sat down at her chair and took out her manuscript, setting it beside the typewriter. "A Talkative Girl," read the title page, and under it was something she had wanted to write for years. By Elisabetta d'Orfeo. She ran her palm over the smooth, cool page, then rested it on the manuscript, as if she could feel its heartbeat. The main character was a girl named Zarina, who was a lot like her, though Elisabetta hadn't intended that. She had made up the plot as she had gone along, and Zarina had acquired a vain and careless mother, a loving but feckless father, and a pet she loved very much, only it wasn't a cat, but a parakeet. And when Zarina had fallen in love with a young man who had fallen out of love with her, Elisabetta had realized that she was writing everything she held in her heart. All of the things she thought but hadn't said. Which was when it had struck her that she was a talkative girl with no one to talk to. And when she had gotten to the middle of the novel, she had found herself writing about an angel who appeared from nowhere, which was strange because Elisabetta hadn't intended to have any magical elements in her book. Then she had remembered that Grazia Dell'Ada had magical elements in her novels, so she had kept writing. And when Zarina was in her most terrible trouble, the angel had fluttered to her side, taken her by the hand, and showed her the way to safety. And that was when Elisabetta realized who the angel was. She picked up a piece of paper, loaded it into the typewriter, and rolled it up. Despite what she had told Nonna, she had finished writing the entire novel except for the dedication. She had been mulling it over all day because she wanted to word it perfectly. She typed, "For Nonna, my beloved angel." Her eyes blurred with tears and her heart suffused with gratitude. Thanks to Nonna, she had let go of everything that had been locked inside her, forgiven her mother for leaving and her father for drinking. She had set herself free so that she could finally breathe. And she did, inhaling and exhaling just once. Fine. The end. She unrolled the dedication page, slipped it under the title page, and squared the stack of papers. She rose with the manuscript, left her bedroom, and padded downstairs in bare feet to surprise Nonna with the news. She went to Nonna's door, where the light was still on, since Nonna always read until late. Elisabetta entered the bedroom, but Nonna had fallen asleep with her glasses on and her book open on her chest. Elisabetta put the manuscript on the bed and went to her side. Nonna was sleeping with her head slightly to the right. Elisabetta hesitated to wake her, but she knew that Nonna would want her to.
"Nonna, wake up."
Nonna didn't stir, but she was a sound sleeper. "Nonna." Elisabetta touched her shoulder, and Nonna's head slipped down, but she didn't wake up. Elisabetta's gaze fell to Nonna's body, which was very still. Her chest wasn't moving, nor was she snoring as she often did. Elisabetta reached for Nonna's hand, but Nonna didn't awake. Elisabetta realized what had happened. She felt her chest wrench with the deepest sorrow. She held on to Nonna's hand, as if it were a way to tether Nonna to the earth, even though she had become an angel, truly.
"I finished my book,"
Elisabetta said thickly, blinking tears from her eyes.
"I'm so sorry I waited to show it to you."
Nonna didn't respond, of course, and Elisabetta realized what she had to do, for it was the last time they would be together. She released Nonna's hand, slid off her glasses and folded them carefully, then set them on the nightstand. She removed Nonna's book from her chest and set that on the nightstand, too. She picked up her manuscript.
"Nonna, the title of my book is A Talkative Girl, so you know it's about me, even though it's fiction."
She sniffled, composing herself.
"So I'll read it to you. And I know you'll hear, and that you're with me right now, together in our house, with our cats and our china. And I know you'll never leave me, ever. Because you always loved me, Nonna. More than enough."
Elisabetta wiped her eyes on the sleeve of her nightgown. It would take all night to read the book, and only when she was finished would she reveal the dedication, though she suspected Nonna knew that already, too.
"Chapter 1,
Elisabetta said, clearing her throat.
Chapter 65. Marco, 13th of April, 1941. Bar Girosport closed for Easter Sunday, and Marco climbed the stairs to the apartment, late for the holiday meal. He hadn't been home since yesterday, and had missed Mass this morning, having been in bed with a woman who wasn't the church-going type. He entered the kitchen to find his father and Emedio at the table, having already eaten the first course. Both men looked at him with disapproval, but Marco pretended not to notice. Buona Pasqua, Emilio. Marco went to his brother and embraced him. You never visit us anymore. Can't that Pope do anything for himself? Emilio released him, his manner judgmental in his black cassock. Why didn't you come to Mass? It's the holiest of all days. I had to work. Marco lied. He couldn't tell the truth in front of his mother. On Pasqua? The office is open? Not officially, but I had things to do for the bosses. That's no excuse. Are you my father now, father? Marco wisecracked, and went to his father, dressed for the holiday in his suit and tie. Buona Pasqua, papa. To you too, Marco. You need a shave. Sorry. Marco remained distant from his father, but it mattered less to him than it used to. He spent all his time at Palazzo Venezia, where he received promotion after promotion. Everyone was delighted with his performance, and he was the youngest assistant in supply administration. His new boss was higher up than Buonacorso, and Marco was being groomed for leadership. Buona Pasqua, figlio. His mother carried a bacchio to the table, a leg of lamb with rosemary, white wine and anchovies served with roasted potatoes. Buona Pasqua, mamma. Sorry I missed the first course. Marco kissed her on the cheek and took the heavy platter from her, breathing in its delicious aroma. He set it on the table next to a ring of golden brown Easter bread, braided with hard-boiled eggs dyed pink and green. It satisfied him to know that the abundance of the meal was due to him, bringing home extra food coupons from work. You missed Mass? His mother began serving the lamb. Her mood seemed better, perhaps because of the holiday. She had on her best black dress, with her dark hair in its braid. I'm sorry. Our Lord sacrificed himself for you. I know, I'm sorry. We lit candles for Aldo. His mother finished serving and sat down. Good. Marco sat down, glancing reflexively at Aldo's chair, which held only a newspaper. Emilio caught his eye. It's hard to celebrate today without him here. No, it's not, Marco shot back. He had hardened his heart toward Aldo, after what he learned about anti-fascists at Palazzo Venezia. They killed soldiers and destroyed materiel and equipment. He had to work twice as hard to make the bosses forget what Aldo had done. Many knew due to jealous gossip. Aldo was our brother, Emilio said, his tone corrective. We mourn him still. His mother frowned. Marco, why would you? His father raised his hand, which silenced her. We all mourn our Aldo. His mother blessed herself. Of course we do. We always will. God rest his soul. Emilio, please say grace. Emilio prayed while Marco fell silent. His father nodded, picking up his fork. Let's begin. Marco took a bite of meat, and it tasted juicy and flavorful, owing to the anchovies. So, Emilio, how are things for you these days? The war is keeping us very busy at the Curia. His father interjected. It's going badly for Italy. We were defeated in Egypt and pushed out of Greece and Albania. Marco knew the details, even more than his father. True, but the Germans have been a strong ally. They sent Rommel and his Africa Corps to retake North Africa. My new boss says even the British admire Rommel. Marco. His father interrupted him, frowning. The Nazi successes are not ours. We are not Germans. I understand. Marco forgot that his father hated the Germans since the Great War. I meant only that they support us. They went into Greece and Yugoslavia, and they're always at Palazzo Venezia. I've become friends with one of the assistants. He's my age, and his name is Rolf Stratten. His father looked down at his plate, clenching his jaw. His mother chewed silently. You're friends with Nazis now? Emilio reached for the newspaper that had been on Aldo's chair and pointed to the front page.
Did you see this?
Marco tensed. He couldn't read the headline, but he recognized a photograph of the town of Ljubljana in Slovenia.
Look at this. A proud exchange of messages between Il Duce and the Führer. What do you think of this?
What's your point? Marco waved dismissively.
Read it, and you'll see.
I don't have to. Who do you think gives the newspapers the information they print? I work at Palazzo Venezia, brother. I know more than you do about this war. And like it or not, the Germans are our allies.
Enough of the Germans!
His father scowled, and Marco dreaded what he had to tell him next.
Papa, my new boss has been after me about you. I suspect his information comes from Carmine.
Emedio interjected.
Who's Carmine?
Carmine is an Ovra officer who knows that Papa gives food and money to Massimo. Ovra doesn't like it. Neither does my new boss. He's mentioned it several times.
His father chewed another piece of lamb.
Ignore your boss, Marco. He's saying that because he has to officially. That's how officers operate. They care only about the chain of command. It's bosses on top of bosses at Palazzo Venezia.
Perhaps, but Papa, you should stop.
His father didn't reply, hunched over his plate. Emedio recoiled.
Marco, you want Papa to stop helping the Simones?
Yes. Marco's heart had hardened toward the Simones, too. He would never forgive Sandro for betraying him with Elisabetta. The pain had gotten worse over time, not better. Ironically, he missed them both. He hated them for that, too.
His father remained silent, still eating.
His mother looked down. Marco couldn't let it go.
Papa, if you keep helping the Simones, you could get me in trouble. You're jeopardizing my career.
His father looked up, his dark gaze even.
Today is a joyful day. Your mother cooked this meal for us. In deference to her and our Lord, I'm going to ignore what you just said.
Marco met his father's eye directly. His mother bit her lip, but said nothing. Emedio broke the silence.
Good for you, Papa. If you can help the Simones, keep it up. This persecution of the Jews is immoral.
Marco looked over.
Oh? What's the church doing to help the Jews?
Our Holy Father is opposed to the Nazis precisely because of their anti-Semitism. If you remember not so long ago, when he was Cardinal Secretary of State, he helped to write the encyclical to the German churches, Mit brennender Sorge. In retaliation, the Nazis opposed his selection as Pope. Germany was the only country not to send a representative to his inauguration.
You're not answering my question. Now that Cardinal Pacelli has become Pius XII, what has he done for the Jews?
Emedio frowned.
Didn't you hear his homily, broadcasted today? He said the war was a lamentable spectacle of human conflict, and that it was a ruthless struggle that had been atrocious. He asked for charity on the home front.
But did his homily speak of Jews specifically? I doubt it.
Emedio pursed his lips.
That's because the Vatican must maintain neutrality, and it has a valid concern about the communist threat. There are fears that retribution against the Jews will take place if our Holy Father speaks too specifically. Even so, there are those who urge a more active role, and I am one. I condemn Mussolini for the race laws. They cause untold suffering.
Marco felt anger flare in his chest.
Don't you think it's hypocritical to ask Papa to keep helping the Jews when the Vatican doesn't lift a finger? Why should my career be harmed for the Simones?
Emedio's dark eyes widened.
Since when are you worried about your career instead of your best friend?
He's not my friend. He can go to hell for all I care.
Marco!
His mother set down her glass, shaken.
What's come over you?
You mustn't criticize our Holy Father on Pasqua of all days. You've accepted too readily this godless view, Maria. Let me handle this.
His father raised his hand again.
Marco? Emedio? This is not the day for this discussion. Let it drop.
Emedio stiffened. Papa, I'm only trying to understand why Marco has changed so much.
I haven't changed. I've always been a fascist.
You used to love Sandro, but now you turn your back on him. You're befriending Nazis and following whatever Mussolini says.
Mussolini is always right,
Marco shot back. But even he realized it was from the Decalogue.
Who are you to accuse me of following my leader without question? What about you?
Me? I'm a priest. You act like a big shot now in your uniform.
No more than you do in yours.
Emedia recoiled, grimacing. I serve God. Whom do you serve?
Il Duce and Italy.
I know you better than that, little brother. It's not love of country that motivates you. It's love of self. Marco felt stung, jumping to his feet.
I could see the same of you. Always the perfect son, the perfect priest, follows the rules.
What's come over you? Emedio rose. Your heart is turning as black as your shirt.
No, it's not.
Marco found himself walking around the table to Emedio. But Emedio stood his ground, his eyes flashing. You've become like one of the mob who crucified Christ instead of Barabbas. The fascist mob that blindly follows the leader.
Who are you to judge? You're a priest, not God himself.
And you're too stupid to question. Emedio started to say. But Marco grabbed him by his shoulders and pushed him back against the kitchen wall, knocking down the Learco calendar. His father leapt to his feet. His mother wailed.
Don't you dare!
Marco raged at an astonished Emedio. Then his father succeeded in yanking him off. His mother covered her face. Marco fled the apartment to the sound of her sobs.
Chapter 66. Elisabetta, April 1941. Elisabetta swept the living room, so the house would be as presentable as possible. Sofia, Paolo's wife, had told her at work today that one of the family's female cousins, a refugee from the country, was moving into Nonna's old room. Elisabetta dreaded the thought of someone sleeping in Nonna's bed in her cozy little room, among her lovely china. Elisabetta had no say in the matter, and she told herself to be charitable, for war was ravaging the provinces, sending people fleeing to the city. Housing was at a shortage, and Rome's population swelled from 1.5 million to 2 million. Elisabetta swept the dirt into the dustpan, feeling the heaviness in her heart. Nonna hadn't passed away that long ago, and grief had become a part of her body, folded into her very soul like an egg kneaded into dough. Rico and Gnocchi mourned Nonna too, restlessly looking for her in her bedroom or meowing at odd hours of the night. Otherwise, they followed Elisabetta everywhere, and even now they watched her from the dining room, curled up on their respective chairs atop their doilies. She never scolded them, and being cats, they were free to express how they felt, unlike humans. There was a vigorous pounding on the door and loud voices on the front step. She leaned the dustpan and broom against the wall and went to the door, smoothing her hair into place. She opened the door, taken aback to find two middle-aged women, one short and one tall, and with them were 8 scruffy children, boys and girls of varying ages. Their clothes were shabby and their faces dirty, and they carried bulging sacks and a rolled-up blanket of their belongings. Elisabetta had been expecting only one person, but it would have been rude to say so.
Piacere,
I'm Elisabetta, and you must be Madonna.
The tall woman stepped inside the house, her mouth agape. Her features were plain, her skin weathered, and she wore her long dark hair in a braid to her waist, country style. She dropped her sack on the floor.
What a beautiful house! Che bella! Look at these rugs, this furniture.
The short woman climbed inside after her, her face gaunt and her body bony, with scraggly brown hair and a worn brown dress. She looked around in astonishment, and the children piled in behind them, dropping their bags and sacks like a small invasion. They raced to the brake fronts and started opening and closing the doors, leaving smudgy fingerprints on the glass windows. Flustered, Elisabetta kept an eye on the children.
I'm sorry, ladies, I didn't get your names.
I'm Nedda Rotuno, and my sister-in-law is Martino Bellolio.
The tall woman scanned the brake fronts, her dark eyes agog.
Giuseppina lived like a queen. We're in luck. We're going to love it here.
Elisabetta hid her dismay. You mean you're all moving in?
There's only the one bedroom downstairs, and I have the one upstairs. I was told only one woman
will squeeze in with ease.
Nedda turned to Martina, delighted.
How lucky are we? This china will bring a pretty penny. We're going to be rich.
Pardon me, Elisabetta asked, aghast. You can't sell Nonna's china. It's antique.
Of course we can.
Nedda gestured around the room.
This is a gold mine. It's all going to the estate sale, and so are these brake fronts. We'll make a fortune.
No, no.
Elisabetta felt a wrench in her chest.
Nonna collected that china. She chose every plate and every pattern for a specific reason. Some of it is decades old. It took her years to amass.
E allora?
Nedda waved her off. She's gone now, isn't she?
That's disrespectful.
Elisabetta cringed.
You mustn't say such things, and you can't sell her collection. Sophia won't allow you.
Yes, she already has. Sophia arranged the whole thing. The appraiser is coming this week, and he's going to give us a price.
That can't be right, Elisabetta recoiled. Sophia didn't tell me, and she doesn't have a legal right to dispose of Nonna's property. Only Paolo does.
Beh, Paolo's not here. Is he?
No, he's at war, but he'll be back.
Elisabetta fought back tears.
The china is what Nonna loved the most. It was hers, and she didn't ask for anything from anybody. She earned it all herself.
Elisabetta, this is none of your business. You're only a freeloader.
Nedda scowled, and just then one of the little girls dropped a plate. One of the blue patterned Staffordshire that Nonna had loved, which shattered on the floor.
Oh, no.
Elisabetta reached for the broom, then hurried over to clean up. She knelt down, picked up the pieces, and put them in the dustpan. The characteristic chink of the shards could have been the sound of